Ira Deutschman has spent the past 40 years working in just about every aspect of independent film. Since graduating from Northwestern in 1975, Ira's been making, marketing, and distributing independent films. He's passing his knowledge on as chair of the film program at Columbia, where he's been a professor of professional practice at the Columbia's Graduate Film Division over the past 25 years. But now, Ira Deutschman is donating his papers to the University of Michigan's Screen Arts Mavericks and Makers Collection. Ira Deutschman, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we get to say hello to Russ Collins with the Michigan Theater here in Ann Arbor. Good to see you here in my studio versus me in your theater.
That's right. Well, it's a pleasure to be here, especially to be on the air with Ira, who has put together a wonderful, wonderful archive that's going to be very insightful for students and scholars, but wonderful insight for the general moviegoer, too, I think.
You know, Ira, it does seem that your career in independent films, it goes back to even before you graduated from Northwestern. You were a production assistant. You were organizing and marketing film premieres. What was it about the world of independent film that pulled you in?
Well, it wasn't independent film. I mean, nobody actually came up with that title for anything until way later. But it was always kind of, I would call it specialized film more than anything else. I just became a film buff as a teenager. Always had an interest in it. When I went to school, I didn't know for sure that I was going to major in film. In fact, you know, when I went to Northwestern, the department was radio, TV, film, and I only knew that I really wanted to be in the media. And what attracted me to it was, you know, that I was living at a time in the early 70s where it was clear that the media was having an enormous impact on world events and in a way that had probably never been true before. And I became somewhat politicized by, you know, the Vietnam War and counterculture, and decided that I just wanted to be in some way influential. But it was over the course of being at Northwestern that I got smitten by this idea of being a curator, in a sense, when I got involved with student activities and started to program movies, and also started to appreciate the programming that other people were doing when I would go to midnight shows at the Playboy Theater in Chicago, and, you know, just the kind of really creative programming that made me very interested in being in that part of the business. So it was really more about the films and about sharing the films with other people that got me interested in it. The term independent film, frankly, was not used for another decade at least.
Russ, how would you characterize Ira's career and the work he has done in what we now know as independent film?
Well, being steeped in the campus film environment that Ira was talking about that was pervasive across university campuses, and certainly was the case here in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan, provided a nice, interesting context and window into what the film culture around the world was, because it was a lot of international and documentary and independent films, again, not called independent at the time. But the way he got into a career that led him to distribute some very well-known films, to start a couple of companies, and he was one of those guys that when I was booking films at the Michigan Theater back in the 1980s, he was just a legend with the films that he was distributing and the quality of the company that he has put together. And the contacts with Robert Altman and John Sayles and Alan Rudolph and some of the legendary films of what we think of at the indie period in the 80s and 90s, we have a tremendous resource with those materials and with Ira still being around to talk about them and will be for many years. So I think it's just a tremendous opportunity.
Ira, you grew up in Chicago. You went to Northwestern. You're teaching at Columbia. Why did you choose the University of Michigan to donate all of these materials?
That's the big question, isn't it? Yeah, it all started with the fact that Michael Moore kept inviting me to the Traverse City Film Festival to be a moderator and in some cases to be a juror. And I met the folks from University of Michigan, found out about the archive. And the intriguing part of it was the fact that the three filmmakers who were in the archive at the moment that I started talking to them about it, two out of the three were filmmakers who I had worked with. And it just seemed that it would be really great from a research perspective to connect the dots, as it were, because so much of my archive has to do with dealing with not only those particular filmmakers, but very similar filmmakers. And it just made sense to do it that way. You know, in a vacuum, I think that my papers might be of value to a lot of people. it's just so much more valuable as part of the larger archive that includes filmmakers who are the types of filmmakers that I worked with throughout my career.
And we're saying Orson Welles, John Sayles, Robert Altman, and those papers that are already in the Michigan Archive give us that insight into the writing and the directing and the acting. You're giving us that unique view of the business of independent film that most of the public just, we don't see that part. We go to the Michigan Theater, Russ screens a film, and it's like it just magically appeared. You're going to kind of open the curtain and let us see what it takes to get that film into theaters like Russ's.
Yeah, that part of it actually could be somewhat controversial because you may or may not know the fact that the film business is notoriously secretive about what goes on behind the scenes, particularly the numbers. And I let it all rip. it's all there. And, you know, I'm hoping that enough time has passed that there won't be any wounded people along the way. But yeah, I think it's important that people have the ability to study those numbers and understand what works and what doesn't work. It's funny how a movie that in its time I lost a lot of sleep over because I was wondering, you know, who would ever go see this movie? Like when I'm in the middle of the process of trying to market it to an audience, and then 25 years later, people are referring to it as a classic, and I'm like, oh, God, if they'd only done that at the time.
Give us a for instance. Give me a title that you lost sleep over, and now everybody just sees what a classic.
Come Back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean, which, but, you know, was a modest success in its time. It was a Robert Altman film that was considered one of his first of many comebacks. And it was a movie that, you know, some of the reviews of the film were terrible when it first opened, especially in New York, by the way. The New York reviews were devastating. And now, you know, they recently showed it as part of a retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art. And the person who introduced the film, who was curating an Altman series at MoMA, referred to it as, you know, as one of Bob's masterpieces. And it's like, okay, well, you know, that would have been helpful at the time.
It would have been nice to know. Thinking for really both of you, Ira and Russ, with your decades of being involved with independent films, what has that story arc been like in your view over the decades? And leading up to the question, what's the state of the independent film right now, Russ?
Well, the state of the independent film is always in flux, but it's strong. The movie industry in general, commercial and independent, has been pretty stable for the last 50 years. But there's always fluctuations from year to year, and there's a constant churning and change, as there is with any art form, whether you think of dance or theater. You know, they call Broadway the fabulous invalid. And they have for decades and decades and decades. And you could almost call independent film the same kind of thing. It always seems to be teetering on the brink, but it always seems to survive. So there's a lot of great filmmakers out there. There's a lot of great films. And matching those filmmakers to audiences is the great challenge that there's always been.
Ira, what's your take on the, if we may call it, the story arc of independent films over your career?
It's cyclical. It's much like Russ described. There are moments where, because either the studios are making, you know, crummy movies that nobody wants to see, or because the marketplace is flooded, there are movies that break through and end up being proper counter-programming and end up doing well. But the truth is that it's never been an easy business. And part of it is, you know, there's a side of me that resists this whole notion of independent film because I hate the fact that people are defined by what they're not. I mean, there's studio filmmaking. That's about a very, very large international business that is one of the few successful businesses that helps the balance of trade in this country. And, you know, that's one thing. But there's this other thing, which is people who appreciate film as art. And is that a business? I mean, I would venture to say that it really isn't a business, not in any sort of consistent way. It needs support in all sorts of other ways, whether it's, you know, people who are donating money to the Michigan Theater so that films like that can actually be seen in Ann Arbor, or whether it's, you know, foreign governments who are putting tons of money into production, you know, into films as art. And the problem with American independent filmmaking is that there is no support on that level for the production of these smaller non-studio movies that are intended to be, on some level, film as art. And there really is no solution to it other than just riding the marketplace, because here and there are films that really do break through. So it's, you know, I would say that we're in a healthy moment only because, as has happened many other times before, there's a current appetite for product. And, you know, the word product, when you're talking about film as art, of course, is a little bit oxymoronic. But it's, but you know, the fact is there is an appetite right this second that's being driven by subscription services such as Netflix and Hulu and Amazon and others that are putting a lot of money into the marketplace at the moment. So independent filmmakers, if you call them that, are taking advantage of that. And I think that's healthy, but you can't pretend that that means that this is an ongoing, sustainable, quote-unquote, business. It's likely that that money at some point or another is going to dry up, and we're going to have to look for the next source.
One of the mistakes I think that people make when they think about the movie industry is they think about it as a singularity, that there's a single market. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't think of the music industry like that. You know, we don't think of
right.
Lady Gaga and the Boston Symphony Orchestra as being in the same market dynamic. Cinema is similar, as Ira was talking about. There's the artistic dynamic to it that can go to an extreme where filmmakers make films basically for other filmmakers. And then there's Star Wars. If you make a film for a few $100,000 or a couple $1 million and you gross $10 million on it, or you gross $200,000 if you make it for $100,000, it can be a successful film. But it certainly doesn't have the worldwide market appeal that a Star Wars or a superhero movie
does. James Bond film. Yeah.
Exactly. So I think that if we're a little more subtle in the way that we think about movies and realize that there are very small movies, medium-sized movies, large movies, extra-large movies, and each one of them has a place in the market, a place in the aesthetic dynamic of cinema, that we can understand it in a more sophisticated way, in the way that we understand music. A jazz musician might have a very successful career and make only a middle-class wage his or her whole life, and we would consider that musician an abject failure if they were Billy Joel.
Yes.
And so anyway, the subtle and dynamic piece of the cinema market, I think, is represented in the University of Michigan's collection. And Ira's contribution to that archive is tremendous in tying it together from a filmmaker having a vision like a Robert Altman or Alan Rudolph or a John Sayles, and then getting that film made, and then getting it sold, having it play festivals, getting it sold, and then actually making it into the market. And some of them you're going to see are very successful, and some of them are not successful. And being able to track the financial dynamics of that, the marketing dynamics of that, as well as the artistic inspiration and the great difficulties to get a film made in the first place and then into market, I think is going to be very illuminating for scholars, for students, and there's going to be books that are going to be illuminating to the general public that come out of this archive. One of them may be from Ira.
I've been speaking with Russ Collins from the Michigan Theater and filmmaker Ira Deutschman, who has donated his papers to the University of Michigan's Screen Arts, Mavericks, and Makers collection. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you. This was fun.